Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. A minor violation of the law may have more consequences than just paying a fine and walking away. We'll explain in a couple of moments. But first, what was life like in St. Louis in 1875, a decade after the end of the Civil War? As it happens, we have the opportunity for a detailed look thanks to the latest exhibit at the Missouri History Museum. It focuses on a giant pictorial map created in that period, showing the dramatic diversity of neighborhoods, allowing us to see how they have evolved. It includes artifacts illustrative of life and living conditions, from mousetraps to monuments. Joining me in studio to talk about the exhibit, some of which you can see on our website at stlpublicradio.org, is Andrew Wonko, the Missouri History Museum's public historian. Andrew, great to have you back with us.
Thank you, Don.
You keep coming back like a song. It just shows how busy you are at the History Museum.
It's been a busy year for me here.
Yeah. So much going on. You guys do such a great job. This is different because this is an exhibit based on a map, and that's a little bit different.
Oh, yes, very much. And when you first tell people that, an entire exhibit about a map, it seems kind of, I don't know, like a letdown. Just one map? But this is a map like none other. In the late 1800s, pictorial city maps, panoramic bird's-eye views of cities, were all the rage. There were more than 1,700 produced throughout the United States. Pictorial St. Louis, drawn in 1874 and 1875, was the largest ever made in the nation, and it's incredible. It's accurate to a scale beyond any expectation of what they could have actually done.
How large is it?
So it was actually published as a book of 110 smaller plates because they couldn't print anything large enough. When you piece them all together, it's more than 24 feet long.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now, who did this? Who put these plates, this map together? I mean, the original map, not the one you've got.
Right. So this was a St. Louisan and an out-of-towner. Richard Compton was a St. Louis sheet music publisher, and he saw a lot of potential in a map that was big enough that you could actually identify individual businesses, because businesses would then pay you some money to have a nice advertisement. So he was the business end of this map. He handled getting it published and getting it created. Camille Dry was a traveling map maker who had spent the last few years traveling the American South making maps of cities. In 1874, he shows up in St. Louis for the biggest project of his life. He had done 12 city maps of cities like Norfolk, Virginia, and Charleston, South Carolina. They were all small individual sheets, nothing like pictorial St. Louis.
I wonder how they went about doing that. I mean, number one, the thing that struck me, and you mentioned, it's a bird's eye view. Well, there weren't, you know, the birds weren't making the map, obviously.
Right.
how do you get that particular view with, unless it was a balloon or something, too?
So it may strike many people as strange today because the old courthouse looks so small in downtown St. Louis, but that was the highest point in the city at the time, around 190 feet. So right, like you said, even if you stood up there, how far can you see? Two or three blocks? Camille Dry was an expert map maker. He knew how to measure distances on buildings just from the ground. He had all kinds of tricks of how he actually did this, and he worked with an entire team of artists who basically canvassed the city, making notes of every single building. There's a legend that he drew this map from a balloon, and while it's totally plausible, we still haven't found any hard evidence showing that that was the case.
Well, that was the first thing that I thought of. It must have been something like that because of the angle.
He had spent time working with the United States Army as a volunteer engineer, where he drew landscapes during the Civil War. So it's very likely he had experience in ballooning, but until we get that piece of evidence, we can't say for certain.
So we have the map and all these plates and a huge huge exhibit, as you've indicated. What is the structure of the exhibit beyond the map?
So what we've done, as I mentioned, he drew the entire city of St. Louis all the way out to Forest Park in extreme detail. Every single house, factory, building, even outhouse, you can spot them lining the alleyways. We've taken 9 St. Louis neighborhoods and blown them up to huge size so people can see this like never before. They're backlit, they glow out into the room, and then we pull out little stories. Who lived in the houses? What was it like to ride on the horse-drawn streetcars? What were the factories making? So we've got 9 different neighborhoods from around the city that people will get to kind of dive into 140 years ago. So aside from these big maps, we've had a local artist named Dan Zetwak do incredible larger-than-life graphic panels showing what is usually a black and white time period for most people 140 years ago. He's brought it to life in the beautiful, vibrant colors today. It's almost like a graphic novel approach, talking about everything from crime to streetcars to what they were cooking in their kitchens to where their water came from.
So you can see an example of what it was in 1875 and also compare it immediately to what's there today. Is that it?
In many cases, you can compare neighborhoods like Soulard, Lafayette Square, Old North St. Louis. In Soulard, there are entire blocks that look almost identical today as they did in 1875. But they'll find other places. Visitors who come to the museum will see places that you can't visit at all anymore today. The St. Louis Fairgrounds, which is now Fairgrounds Park, in 1875, it was a bustling, active fairground. You see the amphitheater, and they had a wild deer park that people could visit, and a horse racetrack, and it's an incredible landscape. So there's lots of those opportunities to see places that are now completely gone from existence.
You're intimately involved with all of this. What strikes you? And you have obviously a great history background and a knowledge of St. Louis. What has struck you most about what you've seen?
I think the incredible thing most people notice right away is just how dense St. Louis was at the time. Grand Avenue was the city limits in 1875, and St. Louis had more than 300,000 people all living east of Grand Avenue. Mm. That's roughly equivalent to the St. Louis city limits, St. Louis city population today, 300,000 people. And so it's amazing, just buildings on top of buildings, seeing the riverfront in its glory days, warehouses 5 and 6 stories tall, all with cast iron fronts. It's an incredible landscape.
And a city of contrasts. I mean, there were
certainly.
It was a Gilded Age, as one of the brochures indicates. You go from Gilded Age and opulence to seedy tenements.
For people who talk about the Gilded Age or the glory days or the good old days, seeing this exhibit shows that for just as many people, life was incredibly difficult. 1875 was a very hard time to be alive for a lot of different groups of people.
Why?
There was endless amounts of workers looking for jobs and very few to go around. Poor-paying labor jobs came and went daily. There was no sort of government systems to keep people from falling on hard times and never bouncing back. It was very easy to wind up homeless in 1875 St. Louis.
Were there any provisions for taking care of homeless people?
Some of the churches had orphanages or had homeless shelters, but usually it was only for men, women, or children. So admitting the family, if you were a family of 7 people, you would end up going to 3 different places, possibly never to see the rest of your family again.
You know, I would have made an assumption that St. Louis being a bustling city at the time, you would not have had so much of this poverty and poverty-related problems associated with it.
Well, so St. Louis was either the 4th or 5th largest city at the time, incredibly large. But as with most river industrial cities, you've got a lot of people showing up for work and a lot of people fighting for these jobs, and there weren't that many. It's the same story in Cincinnati or Chicago. Laborers came to these places imagining a land of plenty, and then when they got there, it was nothing like what they thought.
A little more detail, if you would, about what life was like. I mean, obviously the river would have had to play an important role, as it always has. But what about day to day? What did people do? What kind of work did they do?
So this was the time when St. Louis was starting to really build out a lot more of the industries it would later become famous for. This is when brewing is really taking off, especially in the German communities. In 1875, St. Louis had 29 breweries, and people will be surprised to see that Anheuser-Busch was actually still very small. It was almost like a neighborhood brewery. 1876, the very next year, they, of course, would release Budweiser and take the world by storm. But some of the other jobs included, especially on the riverfront, a lot of heavy industry. You had Charter Oak Stove Company, who manufactured most of the cast iron stoves people used in their homes. You had lumber milling, flour production, tobacco production. St. Louis had an incredible amount of industries that were going on at the time.
I mentioned in the introduction that this was 10 years after the end of the Civil War. Was the impact of that war still being felt here?
Certainly. And on a positive note, especially for African Americans, looking a decade after the Civil War, you see African American communities starting to starting to coalesce and really start fighting for their rights that they now had 10 years after the ending of slavery. 1875 was the year Sumner High School was founded, and that was a self-won point of pride of the African-American community. They had lobbied the Missouri State Legislature to force the St. Louis School Board to provide an African-American high school, which they finally achieved.
Yeah, this was really, I hate to use the word unique, but a different place given its position in the war and in the country.
Certainly. And tensions still ran very high. African Americans were still undeniably on the bottom of that very rigid social hierarchy. But there, alongside race, class started to join as reasons to put someone else down. And so you see like the Irish coming into the city who were oftentimes very poor and had very little, they were often unskilled workers, had little trade value to big businessmen. They were equally thought lowly of. Yeah.
Can you pinpoint a place, a neighborhood perhaps, that experienced the most dramatic change?
I mean, some of them, talking about the 140-year gap between then and now, looking at Forest Park at the time is incredible. We have a shot across what is now the Central West End, and there's twice as many cows as there are houses. There's probably only maybe a dozen, two dozen buildings on the entire map, and this is now where the Chase Park Plaza and the new cathedral mm-hmm. and Barnes Hospital stand.
Well, it's hard to imagine that kind of change,
right,
really, when you think back. And it's a relatively short period of time.
Right.
Right. Let's see. Where else do we want to go with this? There's so many different things. I've looked at some of the material that's come out, and one of the things, slice of life things that caught my eye was a dramatic cartoon of a grave robber.
Right.
was this a big deal in 1875?
Yeah. So grave robbing was something that took place in St. Louis and is well documented. People would go and pull up these recently buried bodies, and they would oftentimes sell them to medical schools. Dissection of bodies was still a very taboo thing and was still kind of something that had to happen behind the curtain. But also, they would just rifle through the graves and steal any jewelry or valuable items people had left with their loved ones. So we actually have a newspaper account on December 14, 1875. A man named Ernest Depke was caught in the act at Picker's Cemetery. He had pulled into the cemetery in the middle of the night, and people at a local saloon thought that looked a little fishy. He ended up getting 2 years in the state prison for that.
Only 2 years.
Yeah.
I'd have given him a lot more hard time than that. I'm talking with Andrew Wanko, who is the public historian at the Missouri History Museum, and we are talking about the current exhibit and the museum, A Walk in 1875 St. Louis. If you have questions you'd like to ask about what was going on at that particular time, Andrew will be happy to answer your questions, I'm sure. Give us a call at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. Send us an email to talk@stlpublicradio.org or send us a tweet at STL on Air. Back with Andrew Wanko in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back. We'll continue our conversation with Andrew Wanko of the Missouri History Museum about the current exhibit at the museum, A Walk in 1875 St. Louis, in just a moment. But first, here are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio newsroom is following today. The family of World War I veteran Sergeant William Schemmann was finally given the Medal of Honor today by President Barack Obama at the White House. Sergeant Schemmann repeatedly dodged gunfire to pull wounded comrades to safety during 3 days of battle. Schemmann's daughter, Elsie Schemmann Roth of suburban St. Louis, worked for years to gather documents in support of the bid for her father. And city council members in Wellston have voted to disband the municipality's police department. The city will be part of the new North County Policing Cooperative, which also involves the communities of Vineta Park and Vineta Terrace. More details are being released at a news conference this hour involving Wellston's mayor. You can learn more about these and other stories this afternoon on St. Louis Public Radio and throughout the day at stlpublicradio.org. Back to Andrew Wanko. Andrew, I want to go to the phones and will in just a moment, but I wanted to point out that 1875 was just about the time when divorce proceedings were about to proceed between the city of St. Louis and St. Louis County. Is that depicted in any way in the exhibit?
Yeah, so we have a full-size wall graphic specifically talking about this topic because it is such a huge topic and still remains so today. I mean, you know, of course, no St. Louisan can say they're unaffected by this. It affects everyone in the region. This was the year Missouri wrote a new constitution in 1875 and authorized St. Louis City and County to formally split into two separate counties. Many people would be surprised this was actually the city who chose to do this because they were tired of taxes being regulated by these rural interests. We talk a lot about how the city got the strange shape it did. There was a lot of reasons why they chose that boundary. Some of the things that happened in the county afterwards, how did Clayton become the county seat, and what happened in the county when it was left without a seat of government. And then try to connect it a little bit to today, talk about how there was three different times reunification has failed over the past and how it still affects St. Louis.
It's impossible to talk about the city in any context without having to bring in some relationship to the county and even to the other side of the river. Does that come into the equation at all?
So he didn't – Camille Dry didn't map the other side of the river at all, so we already had so much content. We had to stop it somewhere. Yeah.
Well, speaking of the map, let's take a call from Rich, who's calling from the Bevo neighborhood. He wants to talk about it. Rich, thanks for waiting. Go ahead.
Always glad to have you as my lunchtime companion.
Great.
I want to ask if this map had been published in folio form. I recall when I was in school at Merrimack about 35 years ago, I came upon a folio that had page by page mapped out the city in such loving detail as you've been describing. And so I'll just take my answer off the air. Thanks.
This is probably the same map that you're talking about. It tends to stick with people after seeing it. So the map was never produced as a single large image. It was always published as a book because they did not have the technology to do such a thing. But it's been reprinted a number of times through the years, always as a book, though.
What was the fascination of that era in these pictorial maps?
So you got to think, this is a time when America is expanding enormously. Cities are all of a sudden connected by rail and river. Cities are having to compete with each other in ways like never before. And what better way to get people to come live in your city, attract businesses, attract factories, than by showing them a beautiful view of your city? So some of these maps that we see, they border on artistic dishonesty. They show what were actually pretty dumpy towns as beautiful paradises of bustling resources. And it was the tourism bureau. It was an advertisement for the city to try to get people to come populate it.
Could these gentlemen make money with a map such as this?
Quite a bit. There were five or six major map makers who really saw a lot of fame and wealth come out of this. Camille Dry was one of the men who made a lot of money. In 4 years, he worked his way across six southern states making city maps. So his name had to be getting around. His work had to be getting around. He didn't just show up in these places. He was likely invited to these places. Charleston said, come make a map of Charleston.
How long did it take to make this map?
So he arrived in St. Louis in 1874. The map was published in 1876, so a little over a year.
Well, again, I'll invite our listeners to take a look at our website, stlpublicradio.org, to get an idea of what we're talking about, because the detail of the map is really quite stunning, as you have indicated. Mm-hmm. Let's take another call, this one from Godfrey, Illinois. John joins us. John, thanks for being with us. Go ahead.
Oh, hi, fellas. Thank you. I had really three quick questions, I promise, and I'll take the expert's answer off air. How vibrant was our riverfront in the era he's talking about? What role did the East Bridge play in the growth of St. Louis? And finally, whenever I go downtown, Don, I look up at a building and it says International Fur Exchange, and I've always wanted someone to explain to me the significance of that building. Thanks so much.
I hope you're not asking me.
So the riverfront was still incredibly vibrant, but it was unfortunately on its way out. The Eads Bridge, as he mentioned, shows up on the map. It was 1 year old. It had just been finished in 1874, and it was the first major connection of America's two sides by rail. It bridged the Mississippi River. Chicago had already pulled far ahead of St. Louis as the rail capital of the Midwest, but St. Louis would become an immensely important rail destination. So the International Fur Building that he mentioned doesn't show up on the map. It's a little too new. But what does show up is its predecessor, the Merchants Exchange. This building stood on 4th Street in downtown St. Louis. And it was actually the largest enclosed space in the United States at the time, 23,000 square feet all in a single room. We actually have a podium in the exhibit that came from the Merchants Exchange building. It's part of the Missouri History Museum's collections.
Well, was there still a lot of fur trade going on out of St. Louis at this period?
There certainly was, yeah. But I would say it wasn't as much as the glory years, 1840s, 1850s, when St. Louis was an enormous fur trading capital.
Yeah. And again, I haven't been to the exhibit yet, but I can't wait to see it. But I noticed in looking at some of the things that have been published that you have a lot of clothing. We have a really good idea of the way people dressed in those days.
Yeah, so actually from our collections at the History Museum, we have four different outfits on display in the exhibit. And it's a fantastic time because clothing was really undergoing quite a bit of change from pre-Civil War to post-Civil War. Gone were the enormous umbrella-like crinoline hoop skirt
Scarlet
things.
Scarlet O'Hara.
Right, yeah. Those had been tucked up into very narrow, very vertical looks. And we have two dresses, a maternity dress and a man's suit on display at the exhibit.
One of the things that I think about often in thinking about the clothing people wore a few generations ago, particularly here, is thinking of the summers and the humidity and the heat and this heavy, heavy woolen stuff that they wore.
While the enormous bulk of the clothes was gone, the layers were still endless. These yeah. people were wearing four or five layers of clothing. And right, can you imagine July when it's 95% humidity out there?
Not really.
Yeah.
What about sanitation during this time?
In terms of sanitation, it was a rough time to be alive in St. Yeah. Louis. Speaking to its industrial heritage, St. Louis was a very, very dirty place to be. We found that the average life expectancy was only 45, and more than half of those deaths were children under 5 years old. So especially for children and the elderly, it was a very difficult place to be.
It hadn't been too many years prior to that when the cholera epidemic hit, and that was devastating.
Certainly. That was only a few decades earlier yeah. and right killed nearly a tenth of the city's population.
And what do we know about home life?
Home life varied pretty widely across the board, depending on who you were. We've got Lucas Place and Vandeventer Place, and Lafayette Square is just starting to become a major center of sort of the most well-to-do addresses in St. Louis. But then on the other end of the spectrum, we've got some of the worst tenement housing the city's ever seen. And most of those tenement houses were given wild, descriptive nicknames like Castle Thunder and Clabber Alley. They were said to live on nothing but the thrown-out milk that was called clabber from local dairies. So housing, depending on where you fell on the class spectrum, could be a very different experience.
You know, I had heard once from someone who I thought probably knew that the tenement building, the tenement architecture, actually originated here in St. Louis. We think of New York City
right.
at the turn of the century, but that actually that it came from St. Louis. Do you know if that's true?
It could be. That's a good. We certainly had our fair share of buildings that were built to house people as quickly as possible, yeah. with little thought given to their health.
But yeah. what is particular about a tenement building?
So the ones you'll see in 1875, some of them had rooms that were windowless. And of course, this again is a time when sanitation is a huge issue. Pre-electricity, the only way people could get lights was through windows, and there people could rent windowless rooms in St. Louis.
Yeah. So this was not an easy time. Was St. Louis typical, do you think, of many other cities that we would be thinking about at this time? The Cincinnati's, if you will. Chicago a little bit different, but other cities of similar size.
Yeah, I think a lot of the river cities share that similar heritage of being diverse places where a lot of, you know, a river brings a lot of goods and people to these places. St. Louis had an incredibly diverse population that was walking its streets every day. We talk about Soulard. You could hear 12 different languages on the streets of Soulard in 1875. I think other places like Cincinnati would have had similar stories, but St. Louis has its own particular brand in the way it developed.
Well, it certainly was a magnet for immigrants. There's no question about
Certainly.
That. I'd been told again, and I think this is true, and I've read it, that there were more immigrants in St. Louis in the middle of the 19th century than there were in New York City.
Again, that could be very true. And everything we've found there were pockets of immigrant groups all over. We had Bohemian Hill, which was where the Czech group who settled St. Louis came to, St. John Nepomuk Church, which still stands today, shows up on this map, and it's really incredible.
So that diversity really is reflected in architecture all over the city.
So especially in these older inner city neighborhoods that hug close to the river, very much so.
Right. Yeah. Tell me something, Andrew, if you would, about the process of putting something like this together. How long does it take, for instance?
Yeah. So this map was one of the things that when I first got interested in St. Louis history, this was what put me over the edge, seeing this incredible map. So right away when we started talking about it, I knew what I wanted to do. I knew where I wanted to go to pull out really interesting stories. But then when it came down to doing more research, digging deeper, this had such a wide range of things we were using to research. I used 1875 government documents. I used school textbooks of the time. I used restaurant menus that we have, all of which we have in our collections at the Missouri History Museum. I was just amazed at the strange places I ended up going when I was doing the research for this exhibit.
And you mentioned the clothing, for instance, the article, the apparel you already had on hand.
Right. So aside from a few architectural artifacts that are on loan to us from Larry Giles at the St. Louis Building Arts Foundation, everything else in the exhibit comes from the Missouri History Museum collections.
We only have a minute left. I saw a picture in one of these brochures showing a mousetrap. Where in the world did you find an 1875 mousetrap?
So again, our collections are deep and varied. And I was amazed to find this one too. Talk about when you had all this cooking going on and plush Victorian furniture, a mouse's dreamland was an 1875 home, and a mousetrap was the front line against the invaders.
And we also point out in just a couple of seconds that baseball was just in its very nation stages at that time.
May 6th, 1875 was the first professional baseball game in St. Louis.
Well, quite a year.
Andrew Wanko, definitely.
It's a fascinating exhibit. And as I say, I can't wait to get over there. People who want to see it, a walk in 1875 St. Louis runs until next February 14th.
Right.
So there's plenty of time to get on over there and learn a little bit more about this great history of ours. That is Andrew Wanko. He is with the History Museum. He's the public historian there. Thank you so much for being with us. Great to see you.
Thank you.
Coming up, there may be more consequences than you may think from a minor violation of the law. We explain in a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.